welcome to the Humble and Fred Show special Friday podcast extra extra. My name's Howard, Freddie P in the basement of the Patterson family estate.
Yes, I am. Another day in the basement because I have a full house. But it's comfortable. It's nice and cool anyway.
That is cool, man. Yeah, this house I live in, it's weird depending on what floor you're in or on, and depending on the season, it's like it can be really, really cold in this studio, but by the time you get to the fourth floor, things start to warm up. Listening to a little bit of music from our guest today, from when that period of time, I was explaining it to Rachel last night. You know, we've been doing this on our own for about 10 years, and early on when Spencer, so we started in 2011, and Spencer, I guess, was like 12 years old. And so a lot of our first few shows and, you know, audience get-togethers featured Spencer singing, and I've got pictures of her in the studio, and it's kind of what she wanted to do. And so she said to me, you know, why don't we, I said, where should we start with this conversation today? She goes, we can talk about, you know, why I don't do music anymore. And I said, okay.
Which is sad. That song off the top is beautiful. Like, it really is. Well, you know what a fan I am of her music. And, you know, when I'm listening to that, I'm thinking, I wish I could add that to one of my Spotify playlists. But is any of that stuff up on Spotify, or do they do singles, or is there any way of taking just a random song and inserting into a Spotify playlist? These are all questions that I need answered, Howard. So answer them, please.
I don't know. That's my answer. I'm not with Spotify. I don't have tech support, but I can send you the songs. And it's funny because we actually used iText. We found a real studio on iText and spent a full day laying down tracks, and I was there for the whole thing, and it was very exciting for her. But that, you know, like a lot of kids, you know, that was her passion, and now it's not. Her passion lately is she's a budding director, filmmaker, just finished George Brown College, and has become very, you know, politically awakened, like you do in your late teens and early 20s, and has a lot to say about the world in general. I mean, you know, I remember you telling me, your son Danny, who just turned 35 this week, I remember you telling me conversations you used to have with him in his late teens and early 20s, like, I don't know why I should do anything. System's screwed, man.
Yeah, the system's screwed. Why do we all just sort of get sucked in and conform to the man? Yeah, and I used to have the conversation that I said, hey, if you got a way around it, go for it, buddy. Because I said, everybody's searching for that. As long as you're not a burden to the system or to other people's work, hard work. If you're totally independent and that's your attitude, just, hey, pursue that dream. Do what you want. Be independent, but just be self-sufficient.
And in an interesting twist of circumstance, it turned out he is. He found something he loves. He is a photojournalist, I guess, or a DOP, depending on the shoot. I've hired him many times to work with me, and he's a great cameraman. And basically, at 35, has carved out a, let's just be honest, I know you're proud of it, so am I. He's carved out an amazing living, basically being independent.
Yes. You know, he would never, you know, in retrospect, he knew what he was talking about, because I don't think he would have ever been a nine to fiver in even in video production or whatever. I don't think he was the type of guy to show up at 9 a.m. and leave at 5 o'clock, you know.
Well, he had an opportunity a few years ago to go back into a full-on, you know, regular gig. I thought it was cool that he didn't, to tell you the truth. It takes some courage. It takes some conviction to stay the course when it's tempting to just go, oh, okay, there's something safe.
Yep.
Anyhow, So I guess I'm trying to set some context for why Spencer, but I can tell you I've had some conversations with her. Not all of them are comfortable, but all of them are certainly interesting, and she will give us some perspective of a 22-year-old during these days, we'll call them. This program, did you want to say something before we do our sponsors?
No, just off the top there, when you said we've been doing this for 10 years when she was 12, I thought you were kidding around a bit, sort of being facetious, but you're not. She was like 12
years old.
That's hard to believe, man.
Oh, yeah. You know, we did, so we started in 2011. In 2012, we had our first Humble and Fred, you know, sort of independent listeners appreciation show, and there was maybe 50 or 60 people that came to watch us record the podcast at night, and she performed with me, and somewhere I have a picture of her, nice black and white shot of her, just a little face into a microphone, and she would have been, 12 years old.
Wow. Fantastic.
So before we get Spenny on the show, just a couple quick things. This program is brought to you by all these nice people, Freddie.
Yes, the retirementsherpa.ca, garbagedate.com/humbleandfred. Remember the /humbleandfred when you sign up, because it makes us look good. 5-Hour Energy, a longtime sponsor, much appreciated. And Clear Air Solutions, relatively new sponsor, but somebody that has been a great supporter of the show.
We actually have a new sponsor starting Monday, which is always such a great occasion around here. The Humble and Fred office is always excited when somebody new takes a chance on us. And one of the reasons they do is because of the people that Fred just said have taken a chance and seem to be enjoying the partnership, like our longtime sponsors, GigSky, The Chamber Plan, CDN Technologies, and a relatively new sponsor, The Health Depot, healthdepot.ca. All our sponsors are listed on our website. So if you want to find out more, go to humbleandfredradio.com. Just a quick thing here. Mike Boone, what did you call him?
Our program director.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Our program director and producer, he said, I suggest, and this, by the way, this is so sweet because this came in at 9 o'clock last night, and you and I spoke just after dinner, so we had already sort of discussed this option. And Mike said, I suggest making this the final Friday episode for a while to keep you guys fresh. Go back to 4 episodes a week. And Fred and I had kind of decided that. We spoke about it on the show this week a couple of times.
Yeah, and then he goes on to suggest what weeks we should take off as summer vacation, which is great.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me. He's got it all mapped out for us.
And I like that. I like that he's also thinking about our welfare and he's thinking about the show. He said, you were there for the first phase of the pandemic when we sort of started adding Friday shows. He said, it gave me a chance to hear what you might sound like if you fired radio. And I thought about that. You know, it's true. These Friday shows, which are just basically the most podcasty ones we've done since we started, you know, really are kind of what it would just be like if we, you know, weren't going to breaks every 25 minutes and pretending we're on the radio and that means something, you know?
No, exactly. A lot of things to think about, some things to consider, and we will do that going forward with Mike's guidance. as you say, he's looking out, you know, for our welfare. But if we take too much time off, we'll be on the welfare.
Well, I hope not. Yes. But, yeah, Mike is looking out for us in a way. And that's it, I love it. It's like every day he sends us a note. When things are good, he gives us kudos. He likes to kudo us. Doesn't agree with everything we say. But is definitely thinking about the show. He has reorganized and reconfigured our website, so if you want to go check that. Plus on social media, if you're interacting with Humble Fred Radio on Twitter, for sure, you're actually interacting with Mike. Now, once in a while, I'll throw something up. I do it more from my personal Twitter. I was in a bit of a Twitter rage yesterday afternoon with Donald Trump, Donald Trump Jr.
Oh, right. Fine, young man.
Oh, yeah. He was talking about the protesters in Seattle that had erected these fences to I guess I'm not sure what they were doing. They were just trying to give some space between them and the police?
Well, they cordoned off a section of the city and declared it theirs, and they would self-govern it, and police would have nothing to do with it, which, you know, it's a little over the top, but just a protest in these weird little times we're in that will come and go. You know, the whole idea is to sort of keep a lid on it and let them have their little tantrum. It's the way I look at it, because it really isn't realistic. But it will fade, and the point will be made, and we'll move on.
So Donald Trump Jr., he tweets, "Wait, I was told walls don't work." So I tweeted back. I just said, "Honestly, at this point, don't you think you should just duck into the nearest shut the fuck up store and grab yourself a bunch?" I thought that was cute. You know, I got some likes. Hey, I'm only doing it for the likes.
No, I know. And he's, you know, him and his brother, Eric. Yeah. Two fine individuals. I read a column yesterday from Ann Coulter talking about Jared Kushner and Ivanka. And she calls them Javanka. Big critics. She thinks that Kushner has been a major screw up in the White House, and he's responsible for a lot of decisions that ultimately have made Trump look bad. So, I mean, I'm not about to get into that, but, well, you know, this is Ann Coulter has lost, or Donald Trump has lost Ann Coulter, which is very
significant.
Interesting. Yes, it is.
I completely agree. Like, by the way, I sent you something as well about the virus. I hope you have a chance to read it this weekend, because you're going to want to crawl back in the bunker.
I know. Very uplifting.
No, I know. I sent it to you, and I thought, I don't know, maybe I should have waited till Monday, because it's so depressing. But, you know, it's significant when Ann Coulter, who was literally early on the go-to Trump surrogate, when Ann Coulter leaves your ship, and part of it started with Trump getting into a shit fight with Ann Coulter's husband, who is also her husband is sort of left leaning and a DC guy of some kind. I can't remember what he does.
Oh, really?
Oh, no,
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Who am I thinking of? I'm thinking of Coulter or Conway. Oh. No, I'm thinking of Kellyanne Conway.
Right.
Who's
who's
also left the ship.
Who?
Kellyanne Conway's husband.
Oh, right. Of course. Yes. He's part of that group, Republicans Against Trump.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that's the beginning. We've mentioned all our, we also forgot to mention QLD and Palma Pasta. Now, I know she's going to make a face because I've already played one of her songs, but I'm going to play a little bit more by way of introduction. Did you just tell me to stop playing this? Is that what you'd like?
I was not forewarned.
Well, no, but it is a part of your history, and it's certainly a part of the history of people that have been listening to you since you were a baby. Mm-hmm. But and Fred and I were, you know, we spent quite a bit of time talking about how much we love this. But
I'm glad. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All your songs. I was telling your dad, I wish I had a way of putting them into my Spotify playlist. Mm. So, like, when I'm up north and one of your sweet songs comes on, people would go, "Who is that?
Yeah,
I've never heard that before. Who is that?" Because whenever I've played your songs for anyone, Spencer, the reaction has been unbelievably positive.
I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Our guest today on this special Friday, the last Friday podcast extra for a while. So I've known this person for a very long time. I met her 22 years ago and felt an instant affinity for her. She's always... What's that?
I said I'm glad.
I've always had an affinity for her. I fell in love instantly and have loved her every day since. Even on saucy days when, you know, even when you were a crying baby. Mm-hmm. Please welcome to our program the artist formerly known as Peach. That's an inside joke.
Jesus.
Spencer Lindsay Glassman. Let me just check your level there.
Hi. Hello, Spencer. That's me.
Spencer is currently living in the east end of Toronto with her boyfriend, Jake, and his mom and sister, mm-hmm. and has been there in isolation.
Months.
How many?
Months, probably three. I've kind of lost count at this point.
Honey,
well, yeah,
Are you talking into the computer or a microphone?
Into the headphones.
Perfect. Keep it closer to your mouth.
Okay. I've been there since the beginning of the quarantine, basically. March 15th. Been here. Yeah.
How's that?
Have you ventured out much?
No, not really. We're kind of like on the more protection-y side of the scale when it comes to the quarantine. Like starting March 1st, I started collecting cans and preparing. Because Jake and my mom and certain people in my life are kind of like early adopters, whereas like other people around us were maybe taking a bit more time to catch on. So like I started buying like not like a huge amount, but like a couple extra hand sanitizer things like around March 1st. And then I haven't really left the house since March 15th.
But lately you've been doing some, you've been going out biking a little bit and.
I didn't have a bike or anything for the entire time. So like transport was really tough and there also had like nowhere to go. But so the last week or so I've been like consistently leaving the house every day because I've been biking. So
nice.
But no, I haven't been into any stores. I don't go into the convenience store. We go one at a time still, like everything like that.
It's interesting how. You know, the pandemic has all kinds of different aspects to it. You know, some people have done nothing and take no precautions. And then there's some people like you and Fred's wife, Delise, and that are sort of on another end. And then there are people sort of I think Fred and I and I guess Rachel and Charlie are a little bit more sort of in the middle where I take precautions. I don't do anything reckless. I'm not going inside places I don't need to be. I'm always with a mask. Yeah. But we've ventured out a little bit more. And I don't think there's
It's kind of a balance of... it's like I'm balancing out my privilege with being extremely cautious because there's no need to put anyone at risk. Like, I have the luxury of not having anywhere to go. I'm not employed in a frontline work environment. Like, I have no reason to leave the house, and I'm not going to do it just for my own, like, benefit. So it's not necessarily like, oh, like I have the privilege and the luxury of being able to be extremely cautious because I'm not demanded to be anywhere. I don't have to like go get food for my family. Luckily I have an app that I can use, but obviously for some people that's just not possible.
So is everybody in the house doing that? Even your boyfriend's mother and what have you?
Yeah, so she like works mainly from home anyway. She has an office in the house. Her job is like very complicated but very interesting. She basically writes grants and proposals to the government to allocate funds to social services, so she can do a lot of that work from home. But I mean, her job does include a lot of travel, so obviously that hasn't been possible. Right. But once we got onto like the food apps and the ordering groceries, it becomes a lot easier. I mean, she's gone out to like maybe a handful of times, but we're all pretty much on lockdown. Yeah.
So your bubble's pretty secure. All right.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, we do the like backyard thing where my friends have biked over a couple times, but I'm not just in the East End. I'm in like the beaches all the way at the other end of the city. And a lot of my friends live in like Rauncey or Parkdale or, so it's like quite a trek to get out here.
So do you think
pretty good.
Will you guys start to, as the province eases restrictions, I think today, in fact, outside of the GTA, I'm not sure if you knew this, that outside of our area, like the rest of the 905 is opening up salons and other services when that happens here. And Freddie, we were talking about it this week. Isn't it supposed to be sometime in the next couple weeks?
Toronto?
Yeah.
Well, it could be next week. It could be the 19th. What's today, the 12th?
The 12th. So Spen, would you, once that starts to ease in terms of regulatory restrictions, will you?
No, probably not. I see no reason to. I mean, a lot of this is just like, this is, again, my opinion based on what I've read and seen. Even this phase thing is basically on speculation and it's out of like a rush to open the economy. I have literally no reason to go out. My job isn't rehiring me and there's like right away, and I have nowhere to go. So I don't really think I need to be part of the guinea pig wave of people who are gonna get sick.
The guinea pig wave. That's good. Well, and I just saw this story yesterday. I don't know if you guys have seen it, that the TTC announced that they're going to make masks mandatory to ride transit in Toronto.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably going to happen eventually. But yeah, that's pretty creepy.
So you said a couple things. What?
Well, that's going to be so tough to police, because you know there are going to be resistors that are going to talk about, that's my right to get on the TTC. I don't have to wear a mask. And so the drivers are going to have a lot to deal with through that, unfortunately, but I can see that coming. Although it's Toronto the good, maybe not so much as it would be in other cities. Who knows?
The unfortunate part of that, though, is even the resistors aren't going to be the ones, and this is a great transition,
yes,
the more heavily policed. It's going to be the folks who don't have access to PPE. It's going to be people who can't afford, you know, masks, sanitizer, who maybe don't understand or not getting the news. Those are going to be the people who are non-compliant, and that's who's going to be most targeted. Like, the people who are like, it's my right not to wear a mask, are often going to be probably left alone, as opposed to seeing like some precarious individual who's like, doesn't really even know what's going on, and it's just like living their life.
So, well, that is a good tradition, because there's a couple of things we said in the first few minutes that I thought we would, you know, start with, which is privilege. And what you just said, there's a lot of people that, you know, don't get the same news feed. And I say that in quotations as the rest of us. But I wanted to start with this statement. And I sent Spencer a note and told her I'd seen this documentary on Netflix last night. Almost, I wanted to see it, but I thought I should at least have that as a reference. It's called The 13th, which refers to the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, which basically abolished slavery with this little tiny exception. And the exception was in the case of criminal criminal conviction. And so what you saw immediately is it went from slavery to anything black men did became a conviction. And you see these pictures of these young kids as young as 6 and 7 in prison garb, because what they basically did is they exchanged slavery for free prison service. So what I wanted to start with you, Spencer, is when people say Black Lives Matter and then those other people go, yeah, but all lives matter. Why is that wrong?
Well, I mean, it's a very complicated question, and I'm not a psychologist, so I can't speak to like why these people. Actually, I can. So when we talk about white privilege, we actually are kind of needing to rephrase that as white supremacy, because I think when people hear privilege, they get really confused thinking it's like a personal matter, like it's about your lived experience. And a lot of folks who are white definitely don't have class privilege and maybe didn't have like a perfect life. So it's kind of this cognitive dissonance where they go, well, I didn't have any special treatment, so how could I have privilege? But when we look at it more as like supremacy of whiteness, which means like historically, lawfully, alleged scientifically, like people have tried to prove that white people were superior through any means necessary, right? So when you look at it like as a systemic problem, saying Black Lives Matter, first of all, and we talk about slavery, how that was legislated is that Black bodies were seen as a property, right? Like, think about that. It's not even to mention just like the horrible nature of like what slavery does to a soul and a person and a generation. But like, if you are just seen as a bought and sold commodity, you're seen as property. So in that sense, historically, Black lives didn't even matter legally. They weren't even, you know, they've been so historically second classified that the most accurate thing to say in protest is to claim that your life matters when no one else would validate that. When the ruling class wouldn't validate that, the empowerment comes out of going, actually, my life does matter. So when people say all lives matter, it's like, no, of course all lives matter, but all lives haven't historically and systemically been treated like they mattered equally. And we can go like, yeah, but slavery was so long ago. But as you so illustrated, it's like, well, mass incarceration is a new form of slavery and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
Well, just last week in Congress in the United States, a anti-lynching bill was blocked which is hard to believe, in the year 2020. And both sides are to blame. Number one, you know, the Republicans for just blocking it because the Democrats tried to throw more into that bill than just lynching. There was an opportunity for them to just clear cut pass that bill as a statement to the world right now. And then they brought politics into it. It's, you know, we think it was in the past, but not so much. Not so much. It's still there all around us.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it's, I mean, I haven't read the entirety of the bill, so I can't like speak to the specifics of what was trying to be included. But I mean, I think this is really a time, and this is, I think, what Andre was trying to maybe allude to at the end of his segment with you guys.
Andre, just for reference, in case you didn't hear the show, it was Andre Domeyes from McLean's magazine that we had
he's
on.
A contributor for McLean's, but he's also like independently just a really strong voice. Like, his Twitter is like, on its own, just educational.
Right.
But so what I think what he was kind of joking about at the end about being like, kind of seemed a little anti-liberal or like in that context, anti-Democrat, right? So I think what we're really seeing is that the, and you know, you can just look at the basic history of the party system and how Democrat was Republican and Republican was Democrat. Like they've been on the same side of both arguments like a million times. So I think what we're kind of seeing is a lot of people who consider themselves liberal are waking up to the fact that liberal kind of can't get a lot done. And I think that, and this is just me, obviously, in my political opinion, but are sliding a little bit more left than they did before this event because they're realizing that Democrat just really means kind of like middle of the road, not really getting things done, status quo. But then farther left would mean like, you know, we're witnessing a revolution. So it's not really the time for, you know, lofty bills and these things. People aren't going to wait around for that.
Well, but as to Fred's point, though, I think it's just another example of it's, you know, the week of June, whatever, 2020, and there are American lawmakers debating whether lynching should be made.
Oh, no,
I mean, no, and I know that's not nothing to do with what you just said, and other than my own.
No, but you're right. It's ridiculous.
My own remarkable. I just find it incredible. And then I listen, in the context of this conversation, I know it's not the only thing people should watch, but I will tell you, watching the 13th last night, as I texted you, Spenny, a lot of that stuff I knew. You know, I remember some of those things, but I don't remember them as specifically. For instance, what I knew it somewhere in my brain that Bill Clinton, you know, who has reinvented himself as this just sweet old grandpa, but he made a huge mistake in terms of black lives. In 1994, he brought in tough legislation, as they all do.
Tough on crime.
And brought in legislation for the three strikes and you're out. And it basically put black men in jail for life for very small third conviction crimes.
Right.
And it increased funding for police, further militarizing the police. And where I wanted to go with that with you, Spencer, is talk a little bit about how that came to be, because the police, the militarization of police is also a fairly recent within our history construct, because it wasn't always that way.
Right. I mean, again, I'm extremely not a historian and only relaying to you what I've read and kind of synthesized, but yeah, so like, you know, if you want to even go back to a piece of legislation called the Fugitive Slave Act.
I do.
Which I can't give you the exact date, but it's somewhere in like the mid-1800s. It was when that period of time where, you know, it was illegal to try to escape or run or, you know, try to get away from your enslavement. So there would be police, sheriffs, they were called slave catchers, who would come, you know, looking for you to basically lawfully bring you back to your quote unquote enslaver, or as it was called, master. So that's kind of like where people are, I think, pointing to the root of police being literally just a tool to police black bodies and to put them where they felt they belonged. But, you know, the militarization of it, I would actually point maybe more to like the mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex, like the later years, because obviously like we're dealing with the 1800s, it was like sheriffs and things that. But when it became this like military force is around more mass incarceration. Well,
and like that's what's scary, because Richard Nixon was saying the same things in the late 60s, law and order. And that's when all those riots started, the sort of hippie movement. It was integrated, ironically, with the segregation movement, and all the first time America sort of brought the military in on themselves, Fred. That's a fairly recent event in our lifetime.
Yeah, and that whole law and order thing, I think of, be it Democrat or Republican, I don't think that's going to change, because there's a whole pile of people up the middle that never offer opinion, and they just love the sounds of that. And that's what scares me more and more than anything about November. I think there's lots of millions of people out there that would never pass comment on Donald Trump, but this whole law and order thing right now is music to their ears. So I don't know what it's going to take. What is it going to take to change? If anything, I think it may dig in between now and November.
I mean, yeah, like, of course, law and order would be music to the ears of people who the status quo was built for. Mm-hmm. And so upholding that status quo is like, it's seen as comforting. But like, I think what it's going to take is, it's not going to be in our control. It's going to take relinquishing that control of like, it's not up to us anymore. Maybe Trump will need to be in office another 4 years to really kind of incite. And again, like, this is something that you guys didn't ask me about, but it gets brought up a lot. Like, the idea, and this is something that I can, you know, it goes back to the three strikes thing. It goes back to the kind of criminality that gets associated with blackness wrongfully. And it's like, the idea of being a peaceful protester in a way is us upholding the law and order that we ascribe to our society, the civility. Like, it's all these ideas that are so ingrained in colonialism, and the idea of going into a people's space and telling them how we feel they should behave, how they should conduct business, because we think, you know, we look down on them and think we know what's best. And it's kind of all ingrained in this idea that, you know, things need to be peaceful and on our terms. And, oh, you can have your protests, but don't, you know, but not at the cost of any. And you know, I don't even want to speak to the extreme rarity of actual unreasonable violence being used within, like, infighting. Like, I don't want to talk about any of that, because really the violence we're seeing is police against these protesters. That's the majority of the violence. But I really think what it's going to take is like a revolution, like an armed violent revolution, like anyone talked about, or, you know, an uprising of government or some form of change of the status quo, essentially.
Well, it's interesting, because one of the things that you and I have talked about, and again, I only speak to it from my own privileged perspective, but I, you know, I'm a bit of a student of all this in a way, and I find it fascinating what you just said, because I agree that something other than the sort of normal course of bullshit has to happen, because Fred and I know that in the normal course of BS, really very little gets done. One of the scariest things about that documentary I saw last night was learning about an organization I'd never heard of called ALEC, which is a group of big companies, Walmarts, and all these companies that basically are writing the legislation or helping to make law, and nobody knows who they are. So lawmakers aren't going to make these changes, which brings me to my next question, Spencer. While these, I don't like to call them riots, while these marches and rallies and protests are happening, two things. To what end? And you can speak to that. And when will they end, do you think?
I mean, I have just absolutely no idea. I mean, I think it's like, you can call them riots. It's, we're the ones placing a negative connotation on that word. You know, like, I don't need to be the one to belabor the quote that riots are the voices of the unheard, right? Like, which is an MLK, which everyone loves to uphold him because he was agreeable to white folks. But, you know, like, I have no idea. I think they'll end when people feel they get a result they're satisfied with. But I also think they won't end in the sense that the unrest won't end until there's real material change that ensures like people's safety. Like, I don't know when people's ideologies are going to change. I don't even care if people's ideologies change. Material change needs to take place to ensure the equality and safety of folks. Also, like, I'm not in the States, right? So I have no connection to that. Also, I'm not in the Black community. I have no connection to the thoughts and minds of where those people are at, what they feel satisfied with. Obviously, the call is to defund the police, which is a very broad term that has a couple more practical applications. But I think until they see real change within the policing system, I don't think there is going to be, hopefully, I hope there's no end to it. I hope people don't give up. I hope they stick around and see real change. But also, again, like, I just have absolutely no idea. I wouldn't even take an educated guess because I have no idea. Well,
when you say material change, what do you mean by that?
Well, there's a quote from Chomsky that's the material world shapes the ideological one, right? So what I'm saying is, it's not like, I'm just giving this as a couple historical examples. It's not like people were calling for people to agree with abolishing slavery. They called to abolish slavery. You know, it wasn't about agreeing that segregation was wrong morally. It was like legislatively, ending segregation. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's about seeing physical and again, like, yeah, our party system kind of fails in this regard. So that's why you do have to see it be a grassroots movement. But I can even, you know, point to some more like small community ways of organizing that people are already trying to experiment with.
For instance, defunding.
Well, stuff that's not necessarily even happened yet, so I can't necessarily talk about it. But, you know, there's people in Toronto, even some that I'm related to, who are the people who do that facilitating. Like, they'll go into a community, they'll, you know, work with the community organizers, experiment with taking away some of the police force and do a trial period so that we can report back and go, so this works, right?
So, but just to be clear, I wanted to talk to you when because the privileged people are freaking out about defunding the police. Mm-hmm. But I think, as you explained to me, it's about funding other things that may not be, you know, these people they hire on the police force, they're not sociologists, they're not psychologists, they're not social workers.
No.
And often they get themselves in a situation where they only have one handbook for reaction.
That should be made clear because, you know, in right-wing media, that, you know, this whole defunding the police, they'll have you believe it means eliminating the police. It just means taking a percentage of the budget and redirecting it to more preventative measures. I mean, that's all there is to it. Makes sense to me. Well, and why not?
It's not necessarily all there is to it. I think a big portion of what people are asking for is to defund, like take funds away and then reallocate. But I also think that we're looking at like major reforms in the way neighborhoods and certain communities are policed. Like, I just want to, like, literally for a second, as the three people in this conversation, think to yourself, okay, if we supposedly have, you know, some number of tens of thousands of police workers in Toronto, how often can you honestly say that you see a police officer in your neighborhood interacting with you? Like, I don't interact with police at all. So I'm really not the one to speak on what life is going to be like without police, because police aren't really in my on my radar.
No, I know what you mean. Other than
actually affect.
Yeah. Other than sirens going by my house, I literally haven't spoken to an officer other than to say hi as I'm walking by him with I have no interaction.
Which is part of our kind of why it's so interesting that people are so like afraid of the idea of having less police, because it's literally all a perceived safety that you associate with having the other people, the bad people, the people that you look down on out of your neighborhood. Like, you expect this idea of police safety to keep the people that you see as criminals away from you. Like, we have to acknowledge where this fear comes from. It's not out of a rational fear of, well, you know, if you take a couple boots off the ground, like, yada, yada, yada. Well, half the time, for example, the three strikes rule, this is in Alabama, obviously not in Toronto, but if there's a man in Alabama, and I'm forgetting his name right now. I can look it up, but I'll just maybe give it to you after if you want to put it out. he had two prior drug use charges. And I don't want to be the first to say that, like, I've used narcotics. Like, it's not like that crazy that, you know, white people use coke all the time.
Yeah.
He had two prior drug charges and then was arrested after stealing $9 because he was trying to get a fix because he was addicted to drugs, which, you know, I can relate to having been. And he was sentenced to life without parole. He's 68 years old, and he went into prison when he was 25.
And, you know, Fred, there's so many examples of that in the documentary. They talked about after the third strike rule came out that drug, and it started with Nixon. Nixon was the first to declare the war on drugs, then Reagan, and then it continues with Clinton saying you've got to be tougher on crime because that's what the electorate demanded it. But the difference was, here's a great example. Cocaine, the powdered form, would get white people basically a fine or a slap on the wrist. But crack, basically cocaine, you know, it was distilled into a rock, got black people life in jail. So just
and if you don't believe that they were putting that crack on the street, you're, you know, living in a fantasy, because literally there's evidence of people in the narcotics unit. They would do a confiscation and they would save a piece to sell it back into the street so that they could continue, because of companies like Alec, because of the desire for mass incarceration, because of slave labor. Like, it's a system that, you know, feeds itself. And also, I want to bring up, because you guys are comedians.
You know, are we? Is that what you think?
You guys remember when you used to make
remember
jokes?
When we used to be jokers?
But, you know, Dad, you definitely know of, you know, the book. It's in the book, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops? But it's just like a Carlin bit where he does that poem, like The American Man or something. And it's just pages of him taking a word, what it used to be called, and then rephrasing it, changing it. And that's a very, like, liberal, but it's, you know, it's all over the map. Like, so he would say, like, a shop clerk, a sales associate, a team member. Like, you know how we've, like, kind of distilled these terms till they mean nothing? Well, think about that in terms of, like, war on drugs. Well, whose drugs? What's the war on drugs? It's always disproportionately affected black communities.
Yeah.
And it's just a new way of rephrasing the war on black bodies. Like, that began, you know, in 1619 when the first ship carrying enslaved people arrived at Point Comfort. Like, that's been the rebrand of racism. And we're seeing it even now in, like, you know, the way people are having these conversations, like rioters and peaceful protests. Like, just always be on the lookout for the rebrand of your biases and racist ideas.
Very interesting. It's funny that a lot of the stuff that's coming out of the president's mouth right now are very similar to the same things, Freddie, that came out of the mouth of, you know, Richard Milhouse back in 1969. Do you have any questions? We have a few more minutes with Spencer Glassman.
No. Even, you know, you talk about all the presidents. Two points I'd make. Like Clinton, you know, really that was, on some level, that's a dog whistle, what he did. Because when he talked about the crackdown on law and order, we know who he was talking about. You know, let's be honest. And we're so naive, we thought the first black president would mean bliss for the black population. I'm really amazed at how many black people, you know, in retrospect, weren't big on Obama because he didn't think he did enough for their community. And then you switch that around and you think, well, what could he have done under that system? And I don't have the answer for that. Mm-hmm. But through it all, it's like, and again, I hate to sound hopeless. It's just all these things that have to happen. It just seems so, such a huge mountain to climb. Where do you begin?
Yeah, I kind of maybe wanted to speak to that because I thought about, like, the conversation that you guys had with Andre and, like, talking about Obama and even just conversations I've had with you, Dad, about Obama. And, like, don't get me wrong. Like, I, you know, everyone had a lot of, not everyone, but a lot of people had a lot of hope that Obama meant genuine change. You know, he's an incredible speaker. He's a charismatic guy. Who wouldn't love him, right? You know, Jake's family, like, watched his inauguration crying, thinking, like, I've never, you know, for context, they're all people of color. And it's like, oh, my God, seeing that optically was impressive. But you have to remember, like, and again, this may or may not align with people's worldview of what politics actually is. But whether he has black skin or white skin, he's a pawn, a pundit. He's a guy elected by the exact same system that created these, you know, the system that created racism. Like, it's not like any, you know, this is again, I think, why we get into some problems when we don't see, when we see, quote unquote, the Black community, as opposed to a huge population of diverse people who maybe have the same skin color, mm-hmm. who we see as one people, but who are not one people. They are people who maybe have some common experiences, but again, varying opinions, varying, you know, he is a neoliberal to the nth degree. There was no reason that he would be even capable or wanting to do real change. Ferguson happened mm-hmm. while he was in presidency, you know?
You know, I'm sorry, Fred, go ahead.
No. It's just because I remember, you know, there was the first term and he had some, you know, I think he had Congress. Anyway, he lost it all in the second term, which made, you know, it difficult for him to pass legislation per se. But at the same time, in that second term, not having to worry about being reelected, you would think he would have just done more. And he didn't. And it gets back to what Spencer just said. It's like he did it. He was that person. So he had to worry about the next Democrat being elected. So, again, he's just part of that system that created where we are.
Well, and just before you answer, Spencer, mm-hmm. what I was going to say about Clinton mm-hmm. was, so if you think about the history, Jimmy Carter was the last Democrat before Bill Clinton. And then the 80s came and it was once again the law and order president. And then there was, after him, it was the Vice President George Bush Sr., who ran against this guy named Michael Dukakis. Now, again, I knew this story, but I'd forgotten about it. The story of Willie Horton. And Michael Dukakis was way ahead of the polls, a Democrat. And then they turned it into, isn't the Black man evil? And we have to be very careful, or this Willie Horton and others like him will leave prison and rape and murder. Mm-hmm. So in 1990, mm-hmm. Bill Clinton went, well, if I'm going to get elected and I'm a Democrat, then I've got to ape the same nonsense mm-hmm. that these Republican presidents have done, which is where the three strikes came in. Again, to Spencer's point, you know, a lot of people thought, oh, Bill Clinton's liberal and blah, 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 but he still had to kowtow to the same establishment in order to get elected.
Yeah, I think it's like any, and this is just an exercise that, like, I think is helpful anytime we talk about these things, is to kind of zoom out and look at, like, this is a pissing match between two parties. Mm-hmm. You know, this is that it's the same two parties. And there's been three, there's been four, but the same two parties that were created by like a room full of white guys who all owned slaves. Like, whether or not, and I'm not actually taking away like the accomplishment and the hope that people experienced when Obama was president. Like, I'm, you know, we cannot take away from that. And we can't know what that must have meant to Black people. We can't even fathom what that could have meant just to see someone who mm-hmm. looked like you. You know, it's like, that is beautiful and that is healing, and I'm not taking away from that. But to ever think that someone who holds the seat of president would have the people's interest in mind, the real people, like the people who aren't in government or who not the top even 10%, you know, not to mention the 1%. It's like, that's, we're, you know, to go back to Chomsky, it's like a failed state. Like, the system was designed very poorly to serve about five people, you know?
So now we're in 2020. We've gone through 3 months of a lockdown, and we all thought that would be the big story of the year. Actually, if you go back to January, we thought the Australian fires would be something we'd never forget, you know?
Buckle up.
Buckle up is right. And then, you know, then this happened. And one of the things I can say, maybe Fred can speak to it too. You know, I remember, you know, the riots of the 60s because, you know, the movies and being a kid, and then MLK gets assassinated. There were rioting for 5 days. In 92, L.A. was set on fire after Rodney King. You mentioned Ferguson. But mm-hmm. unlike all those things, because it's happening now in the world of the world where everyone can record all this nonsense.
Yeah.
What I find interesting is that it's taken hold all over the planet. Does the fact does that fact make it different? And do you think that fact makes it more likely that something will change?
Well, I think the one thing that, you know, it's an interesting question, but the one thing to point out is, like, I think one of the inciting factors of why you're seeing such a response right now is, like, it's a kind of like the, it's like when a serial killer like makes a mistake, it's like, ooh, they like left a piece of evidence or they made a mistake. Well, here's the mistake. When you relegate an entire population of people to be the working class that support your country, and then you make them all unemployed and they have nothing else to do but focus on the thing that they've been living through since the beginning of time. And then you have all these other white people who also are unemployed, and you have, and you know, it's like everyone's unemployed. And you know, you can look at like the origin of capitalism, but also this concept of like racial capitalism, how like black people literally built the economy in an unpaid situation.
That's right.
And so now you have all these folks who have kind of been systemically oppressed, don't have to go to their day job or can't go to their day job. And then you have everyone else who's like also not going to their day job. Of course, you're going to see this unrest because people can finally have the time to speak up for themselves because they're not so busy. You know, they can't provide for their family. So it's like, fuck it. You know, this is the only time people, it's actually a beautiful intersection of capitalism and which is the, this is a consistent intersection of like capitalism and racism intersecting in this way where, yeah, like, of course people are going to be, they finally have the time, you know?
All right. We've got a couple more minutes before we're going to shut it down. Fred, do you have any final thoughts? Cause I want Spencer to have the last word. Do you have anything?
No, other than that, again, I don't like to, I just try to get my head around where this change is going to come from and how is it going to happen. I mean, right down to, you know, Obama was elected because, you know, the black vote came out in numbers like never before. And then when he wasn't running, they didn't. And I just wonder going forward now, are they going to feel that hopelessness and with voter suppression again, not come out? And then just ultimately, again, if Trump's being reelected, just become more of a victim. I just, like, I can't see a way out of this, personally. That's all
I
would say.
I think luckily, like, and I mean this, like, truly with love, and it's for all of us. I think luckily nobody's asking our opinion anymore. You know, it's really, like, follow the lead of the people who have lived this experience. Follow the lead of the organizers who do know the way out, who are calling for a very specific way out. You know, like, I think the real takeaway is that our way out doesn't really matter because it's never worked for anyone but us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think the kind of the calm, I mean, it's an uncomfortable situation. It's uncomfortable work and it should be, but I think the like, just kind of like hang in there because people know what they need. And I think that's a huge part of white supremacy is that we are programmed to believe like our thoughts, feelings, and opinions are just so, so beyond valid. You know, it's like I've been instructed by some people in my community that like to be a true accomplice, not an ally, an accomplice is to go, yep, I'm there when you need me. Whatever you say, we'll ride. If you want this, it's this. If it's not that, it's not. Like whatever people are calling for, all you have to do is show up to that. We're not being asked to make any decisions. We're actually being asked to listen. Which is such a fucking nice position to be in, you know? Because we get to support a community that knows what it needs. Self-governance. This is the concept, right?
I just want to mention Spencer has a GoFundMe campaign. It is a... you can donate to... it's a dollar store gift cards for sistering participants. Is this not... Can I not mention this?
No, you can't. It's just... I did such a poor job...
Of naming
labeling.
It?
Yeah, it was because it wasn't like supposed to be any type of viral campaign. I'm just trying to get some.
Your sister's in branding. Could we not have, cobbled something together? Anyway, how do I get? If you want to donate to this, explain what it is quickly, and then how people can donate.
So I'll just like lead you with the link, and maybe I'll change the name of it. But
I'm just kidding, honey. It's fine.
So sistering is formerly a drop-in center for precariously housed, aka homeless women and trans folks living in Toronto. Why I say formally drop-in is since COVID, they were granted temporary bedded status, meaning they had to basically kick out 70% of their population, but now 30% of their population can sleep and has a bed for the first time, right? So this population is largely Black, largely Indigenous, largely trans, you know, it's like and precariously housed, aka homeless, women and trans folks in Toronto. And basically what they need is gift cards because we can't you know, they can't handle cash because cash has become unsafe for everyone because of the virus. So the staff there asked me, my friend who works there, asked me to try and, you know, put together some gift cards for things, you guys will love this, like getting paid to do chores and, like, you know, getting some responsibility, some microfinancing, as it were. But then also, like, when they play bingo, like being able to give out gift cards to Dollarama and Shoppers so they can go out and buy themselves the goods that they need.
Okay, what I'll do is I'll send the link to Freddie. And can you put it in the show notes somehow? Can we do that? All right. Mm-hmm. Listen,
Facebook.
Thank you very much for taking some time. I really appreciate this. You know,
I'm glad you're open to having the conversation.
Well, very much so. Yeah.
Yes. And your passion. You know, what's great is your passion, your intelligence. And then on top of that, I mean, your age as well. I mean, you know, people like us who have lived 60 years, sometimes we really need the perspective of, you know, somebody on the ground, so to speak. And that's what you provide. No, seriously.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, like, that's the nice thing about community is, like, we benefit from the wisdom of our elders, but, you know, people above us can benefit from just the pace at which we are able to work at. Like you said, you know, you kind of express being, like, tired, or it feels like this this weary thing. But truly, like, I'm sure a lot of older folks are feeling that in a lot of ways. Like, you know, look at the older Black community who's probably just, like, so tired of fighting this fight.
It's funny you say that, because I just happened to watch the beginning of a Chappelle show he did this week outdoors, and he did it the first stand-up concert, and I'll send it to you. It's fantastic. But one of the first things he says on stage is, he says, I just want to thank you younger Black folk for, you know, taking the lead on this, because, you know, he's in his mid-40s, just admitting that, you know, this isn't the, you know, we can all make changes and learn and be open to new ideas, but it's your generation and people of your ilk that are going to do this. You're going to drive the bus on this.
Right. And, you know, Howard, that's such a key point, because, you know, you get back to that tired thing. People our age, the people in charge, are tired, you know. Let the next generation or the next guy to have the job worry about it. And, you know, not to keep talking about the states, look at both guys running are in their
70s. I know.
That's why it's
so... we'll see that change in the future, like, but young people can be pundits, too.
No, I understand. But, you know, you only need to be 35 to be a president. Why don't we try one of those and see what it takes?
Or why don't we try... My newest idea was... Mm-hmm. I think I said this to you on the show. And you've said it, too. But I read it, and I think it's really true. Let's get ourselves a female president. And the person what I read was, once we get one female president, we may never go back to the old white guy model.
I mean, but don't be too hasty on that, because there are for every Bill Clinton, there's a Hillary Clinton.
I know.
There's an Amy Klobuchar. There's all the dumbass. I mean, also, whatever. Mm-hmm. I've given up on politics. I can't wait for you guys to give up, too. It'll be awesome. Stop looking up to these, like, false prophets. But basically, one thing I want to say, I just leave you with this last thought, is, you know, It's not an overnight matter, like anything. I'm talking about, like, the personal work that white people can do. I know people are, you know, calling a lot for, like, check your privilege and examine this. Okay, whatever. Those are all buzzwords, and they've lost meaning anyway. Mm-hmm. One thing I will say, if you can, like, if you read even a book a month, or you watch one TV show a week, if you just endeavor to invite one, you know, one Black voice into that experience. Like, for example, I'm reading a novel right now. Black author, Black mind a little bit more. Like, it's not always about learning about racism directly, but also just widening your experience to realize, like, you're not the only consciousness, and your skin is not the only experience. Taking in new information when you can.
Thank you, my honey. Just stay here for a second while Fred and I say goodbye. Thanks, everyone. This was, as I said, the last Friday show, and a great one to end on. We're back live Monday, best of the show. I guess it ran this morning. It will run again tomorrow on Funny 820. Fred, this program also brought to you by...
The Retirement Sherpa. GarbageDay.com/HumbleAndFred. 5-hour energy and Clear Air Solutions.
Also, Gig Sky, the Chamber Plan, CDNTechnologies.com, and the Healthy Depot. Excuse me, HealthDepot.ca, as well as our friends QLD and Palma Pasta. Spencer. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Spencer.
I love you, Spencer.
Love you guys.
Okay. Love you guys.
Yeah. I'm kidding. You're sweet. I go, I love you. She goes, I love you.
She doesn't love me the way she loves you. But I mean, maybe she loves the idea of me.
Oh, that's funny. Just hang on a second. We'll be back on Monday. I love you, but you're freaking me out. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down. New York, I love you, but you're bringing me down.